but it's down to Cologne Ranger and Jeremy's Jet. Which of these will take the lion's share of $1 million? Jeremy's Jet on the inside, dead game, captures the metro!
Moving pictures on the backfield is coming on! Moving pictures on the far outside, reaches up for Mark McDonald to win the Breeders' Crown Open Mare Pace. It is Moving Pictures with a 9-1 stutter and 1-3-1.
Tying up on the end of it, trying to reach Mystical Sunshine, and it's Peaceful Way with her brilliant winning way to capture the Armroad
Claim. The Claymore has done it again. The Grey Gladiator, the Gladiator Gris, La Ferra Provençoise, une 74e victoire en carrière.
Coast to coast on the World Wide Web, this is Trot Radio on standardbredcanada.ca. He's won more purse money than any driver or jockey in the history of horse racing. Youngest driver elected to the Harness Racing Hall of Fame, a member of the Canadian Horse Racing Hall of Fame, and now soon to be inducted into the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame. Stand by for a very special two-part edition of Trot Radio in conversation with the legendary John Merlin Campbell. Up next on Trot Radio. Welcome back to Trot Radio. You know, what I love about this show is the fact that I get to interview the very best in the business, and it doesn't get much bigger than our next guest. I feel like a kid at the dressing room in the All-Star game. John Campbell, from his roots in southwestern Ontario to the big lights of the Big M, I should say. Welcome to Trot Radio.
Thanks a lot, Norm. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your election to the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame.
Well, thanks very much. It's certainly something I'm very proud of. It's an honor and a privilege.
And the other thing I need to congratulate you on is the good sense to be born in London, Ontario.
Yeah. I didn't have a lot of control over that, but it's worked out well.
Yeah, you've done okay for a kid from London via Elsa Craig. Let's go back in time a little bit. You won your first race in 1972 at Western Fair, right?
Yes, I did, and I might add, I had very few supporters. The horse paid, I think, $92 or $94, so it wasn't like there's that many people can say they bet on me the first time I won.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time John Campbell has brought home a 50-to-1 shot.
No, I've had a few of them over the years.
Now, you began your career then, but obviously your love for the game started at a much younger age. The influence of your grandfather, Duncan, talk about pedigree. You're at the farm in Nairn with a souvenir whip given to you by Ronnie Fagan, and you're pretending that you're winning races. Talk about legendary Fagan. There's another one for you. Did you ever think it would come to this?
No, it certainly wasn't anything I've ever dreamt of. When I was a kid, I had an old race cycle tied to an old pump, and I won a lot of races there, but most of them were in London and maybe at Old Woodbine when I was really young. You know, as I grew up, New York was the thing that everybody strived for, to try to get horses good enough to race at Yonkers and Roosevelt. And in my wildest dreams, that's what I was hoping would happen to me, that I'd have enough good horses to go to Yonkers or Roosevelt some days. And, you know, when the Meadowlands came along, it changed everything, and catch driving changed everything. So, what I was dreaming about when I was a kid is certainly changed as my career progressed.
Now, you were driving and training down at Windsor, and the call came from the Meadowlands. How did that all come about?
Well, Joe DeFrank had been race secretary at Windsor, and he knew my dad and myself well. And when he came to the Meadowlands, the first year it opened up in 1976, Ray Remen and Greg Wright came, and they did very well. And that gave me the idea that, you know, if I was competing against those guys in Windsor and Detroit, you know, why couldn't I compete against those guys for more money in New Jersey? And I happened to run into Joe DeFrank at the Little Brown Jug that year and asked him, you know, what are the chances of getting some stalls and giving it a try? And he was very encouraging. He said, put in an application. You know, he said, I'll give you some stalls. And that's what I did. I took 14 horses down from Windsor. I had a stable of 24, I think, at the time, and I just took the 14 best ones. And my wife was pregnant with our first daughter, and away we went. And my thinking was that if it didn't work out, I could always come back for the Hazel Park meet in March if we couldn't cut it. And we've ended up being here ever since.
In conversation with living Hall of Famer John Campbell, who's being inducted into the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame on Trot Radio, I was just going to ask you, would that have been, when you said to yourself, look, I can compete with the Remens and Wrights of the world, was that an aha moment for you when you said to yourself, you know what, I'm good at this game?
No, not at all. I don't think there was a an aha moment at that time for me. I thought, you know, the money was so good at the Meadowlands. It was something we'd never seen. And, you know, I knew you didn't have to win all the races to make a lot of money down here. And, you know, so it wasn't an aha moment then. I think maybe the first aha moment I had was when Mary Isle won the Oliver Wendell Holmes against Hervé Fillion and Hot Hitter.
Now, that now you're talking some currency there.
Yeah. I mean, that was the first, you know, major three-year-old race that I'd raced in New Jersey. And, you know, Mary Isle was extremely sharp, and he won all his races that winter for John Burns and myself. So, and when he stepped up and beat those top Grand Circuit colts, I thought, you know, maybe we can do something down here.
Well, it sure worked out. Who do you think gave you your biggest break in the sport, John?
My father, Jack, and my grandfather. That's where I learned all my horsemanship, how to deal with people. And, you know, I give them all the credit in the world for the background that I have in racing. And, you know, it's lessons that I learned from them that I still carry with me today about horses. And you know, just everything that I've become is from them.
Well, you know, you've managed to avoid the social traps that have befallen a lot of other talented reinsmen. You know, we see many cases of it, you know, and you know what I'm talking about, guys with million-dollar hands and 10-cent brains. Would you say your family is what has kept you so focused?
Certainly. They gave me a great start. My wife, Paula, has been just unbelievable throughout my career, you know, tolerant of my schedule, and I always laugh. She keeps me grounded. I think the first time I won five races at the Meadowlands, and nobody had won five at that time, and our neighbor, a couple days later, he said to me, "Well, what'd you do after you won five races?" And I looked at Paul, and we both laughed, and I came home, and she told me to take out the garbage.
Now, that's grounding.
Yeah. So that's, you know, she's been the backbone of our family life and kept everything in perspective over the years. So, I had very, very fortunate in her support and companionship through the years.
And did you guys meet in Jersey or up here?
Actually, we met in Detroit.
Okay.
Her stepfather trained horses. Her father owned horses, and she went to the race Wolverine, and we were introduced by a mutual friend, and we just, from the time we went out, we've been together ever since.
Now, those of us that are less gifted can only wonder what it's like for an individual like you that has the soft hands. Guys like me, we're known for having anvil hands. But are great drivers, and I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but are great drivers born, made, both?
I think you're great drivers with the exceptional touch are born. I think I've seen many times, you know, guys that start out driving at the same time, and one guy will just be better than another, and their horsemanship might not be the same. The fellow without the touch might be a better horseman, but I think it's something it's just an ability that you're born with to communicate, to recognize pace, speed, and how your horse feels on the lines, and it's very difficult to describe just how that works because it comes natural to some people.
That's something I've always believed. I just think it's an innate ability. It's for lack of a better term, God-given, really.
Yes, and, you know, I like to say, you know, driving horses isn't that hard, but there's only a few can do it really well.
Very true. By 1987, you're a big player at the Meadowlands. You've had your first $10 million season, and since that time, six Hambos, three Jugs, seven Meadowlands Pace victories, North American Cups, Breeders' Cups, an Elite Lop, an International Trot. Which one's the sweetest for John Campbell?
Well, I think there's three that stand out. My first Hambletonian with Mack Lobel, because it was my first, and you know, Mack Lobel meant so much to me. I just thought he was one of the greatest horses we've ever had. Winning the Hambletonian with Tag Labou because my brother trained him, and you know, that was just a fantastic day for Jim and I and our families. It's just an indescribable feeling. And I think winning the last Hambletonian with Glidemaster was special just because it was after I'd come back from an injury, and my daughters were a little older and were able to grasp, you know, the concept and how important it was to win the Hambletonian. So I think those three really stand out more than any other races, that to me personally anyway.
Master who explodes for Campbell. Chocolatier's closing wall as well, but it's Mr. Hamiltonian, his sixth win in the Hamiltonian, John Campbell and Clyde Master.
Well, looking at your background and in interviews you've given before, you've always had a partiality, I think, to the Hamiltonian. The three jugs, though, was the life sign victory as sweet to you as it seemed to be to the rest of the racing world that voted it the best jug ever?
Absolutely. I was just in awe when I went around that turn after the race, what that horse had done. I mean, it was just a terrible drive that worked out because he overcame it. I mean, he was just so tough that day. And, you know, the jug is an unbelievable feeling, and certainly winning my first with Merger, you know, that was my first Triple Crown race, and my mom and dad were there for that, and so it that was special too. But I was the same as everybody else, just wondering how that horse could overcome that trip that day, and it was just an amazing performance.
White Sign's coming on! Rio! White Sign on the outside! White Sign wins the Little Brown Jug as John Campbell waves the whip in the air.
John, you've, you know, like most drivers, you guys are warriors. You've suffered some pretty nasty injuries on the track. I mean, you just come off of elbow problems in the early part of the decade, as I recall, after a spill, I believe it was. Would all that pale in comparison to, let's just call it, the spill at Woodbine a couple of years back?
We'd also like to inform you, the ladies and gentlemen, that John Campbell has been placed on a stretcher after being tended to by the local paramedics here at Woodbine Racetrack.
When I broke my arm and elbow, it was about as severe as the leg, to tell you the truth. They're both equal. I came back a little bit sooner with the arm, but then I had to rest it in the wintertime. So they were both very similar in severity. You know, it's just it's part of the deal. You know, if you're want to drive horses, you sign up for stuff, and there's always that risk that that can happen.
What I find amazing, and you're fairly typical of this, is your ability to rebound. I mean, that leg was broken how many places?
Oh, I couldn't even tell you. It was, you know, shattered in a couple spots. It was, you know, a bad break. But, well, I mean, but it's healed up now, and I choose to move on and move forward.
Yeah, well, you're in the top 10 drivers last check on the Meadowlands for this year, so obviously the leg's fine.
Yeah, the leg is no bearing on my driving at all. It's actually, when I went back to racing, I was really surprised and amazed. Just I had no problem with it, I had no pain with it, and so it's healed up very well.
Now, what advice would you give to any young man or woman right now who's thinking of entering harness racing as a driver? My first reaction would be, what, are you crazy? The sport's dying. But it's not. We know that. What advice would you give?
Well, you'd have to be dedicated, that's for sure. I think it's much tougher now than when I started in the business. It's the competition for drivers especially is tough, because even if you go to the smaller tracks in Ontario and look at the driver's roster, there's five or six, you know, seasoned veteran drivers that are racing in all those races. And to race against those guys, it's very difficult to get an opportunity. It's very difficult to be successful. So I think dedication would be the first word that would come to my mind for advice. And you'd have to recognize rather quickly whether you do or don't have talent for that. And that's a hard thing to do when you're just starting out, is for a young fellow to develop and get the opportunities. When I started driving, I wasn't very good. I was terrible. But there wasn't the pressure on drivers at that time, and I had opportunities from my family to work at it and get better. And, you know, that's not an option for a lot of young drivers starting out today.
Well, you're a very humble sort. We all know that. I remember a quote from you saying that, you know, all the great things you've done would pale in comparison to drivers of previous generations because they trained. Do you really believe that?
Well, absolutely. We get more opportunities. And, you know, if you're training, whether it be 40 or 50 horses, which is a lot, you know, that's what you had to drive. And that's what you had to get you through the year. Whereas, you know, as catch drivers, you know, if we get a top three-year-old that falls by the wayside, we've got a chance of picking up another one. And, you know, so it's much easier to stay in the top echelon when you can change horses during the year, whereas when you're training, you're stuck with those horses for the year, and if they're not good enough, that's what you have to deal with.
Yeah, no fun facing those guys next morning after you haven't picked up a check.
Well, no, and it's, if your horses aren't good enough, it's like taking a knife to a gunfight.
fellow Canadian Sports Hall of Famer, Keith Waples, recently said that one of the problems he's had with the current catch driver situation is that the drivers really don't get a chance to know a horse. They're just hopping on whatever's hot.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that. But as drivers, that's what you have to deal with. That's kind of the hand you're dealt. Now, you know, as a driver, knowing which trainers I'm dealing with is a big help because, if you know the trainer and have confidence in them and have confidence in their opinion, you know, you can get a lot of information before the race and looking at the program. Program doesn't lie. You know, it's there. It's right in front of you, and it'll tell you. But there's no question, after you've raced a horse three or four times, it's an advantage to know what that horse is capable of and what he can and can't do in a race.
Well, John, you've won some great races, all of which have been called by some of the great announcers in our game, and we've got on tape some good wishes from a couple of them.
Hey, John, it's Sam McKee from the Meadowlands. Congratulations on this tremendous honor. I can't think of anybody who deserves it more. What I've always admired about you is not only your talents on the track, but the time you take with the media, the time you take with the publicity department, and the discussions we've had about harness racing, just sitting down and talking about the sport. And certainly you've got a well-rounded perspective and some great opinions on harness racing, and your success on the track is just half of what you've accomplished. You've been a leader for our industry, and for that, I thank you personally, and everybody in the industry thanks you as well, and congratulations on the greatest career in the history of our sport. Good job, John.
Hi, it's Frank Salee from down at Western Fair in London, where John Campbell got his first win as a very young man in the early 1970s. But later in life, I have a special memory to offer about John Campbell. In the 1990s, on the Toronto circuit, he was the dominant driver in the North America Cup. And in that decade, he improvised six different winning drives to win the North America Cup in that decade alone. About the only problem I've ever had with John Campbell is his golf game. He plays from the left side. His backswing is way too fast, way too much head movement during putting. But otherwise, John's a great, great guy, richly deserving of this reward. He gives a lot back to us here in Canada by coming to the Legends Day at Clinton Raceway every second year. And we always look forward to his return home and this permanent honor for him at the national level.
Coming up on the next segment of Trot Radio later on this week, part two of our interview with John Merlin Campbell, as he's known, as Legends Week continues on Trot Radio. Trot Radio is a presentation of Standard Bred Canada, produced by Boer Communications. Technical producer Chris Knowles. The opinions expressed on the program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Standard Bred Canada or its affiliated racetracks.